We are actually done with this chapter. The only reason I put this final slide up, 31, is just to let you know that I usually don't say anything about this because this is just a summary slide. So I've already covered all the stuff that's in this, not to say that it's not important. It is all important information. It's a good thing to look at when you study, but I'm not going to read the slide to you. So that brings us to the next chapter, which is a tour of the cell. We're going to survey the major parts of a eukaryotic cell. Before we do that, though, let's just notice in slide one that a typical eukaryotic cell is about 1,000 times as big as a typical prokaryotic cell because it's 10 times as big in all three dimensions, 10 times as long, 10 times as wide, 10 times as tall, and therefore it's 10 times 10 times 10 times as big a volume, or 1,000 times the volume. But even despite that range, and there's more ranges, there's some extraordinarily big cells and there's some extraordinarily small cells, but whether it's a prokaryotic or a eukaryotic cell, they all are in a pretty small range overall in terms of size. This is a huge range of size, because this, just like the pH scale, this is also logarithmic. This is not linear, so these are not the same size. They look like the same size as you, but each step is actually 10 times bigger than the step below. And so it goes from a nanometer down here, the size of atoms, a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a meter, up to 10 meters. That's a huge range. Well, the yellow part where the cells lie, and they lie in the range that is invisible to the unaided human eye. We can see things bigger than that, but individual cells, no. We need a microscope. And there are a couple major categories of microscopes, light microscopes and electron microscopes, that operate differently. Light microscopes operate on the basis of light shining through the specimen that is to be magnified by that microscope. Those are the ones that we use in this course in the lab. Electron microscopes operate by either sending a beam of electrons through the specimen or bombarding it with electrons. In either case, you're not looking at what's coming through. It's electrons that are coming through. Instead, that forms an image on a computer screen. But the big advantage of electron microscopes is that they can they have much more resolving power. They can see much, much tinier objects down to the molecular level, almost individual atoms. So let's go on and talk about cells. I said that the chapter is about eukaryotic cells. That's true for the vast majority of it, but just for comparison, let's look at a prokaryotic cell in slide 2. Now, we've already talked about differences between prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells, including the difference in their names, right? They are named just on the basis of one of their differences, which is the absence or the presence of a true nucleus, right? That's what the names actually mean. Prokaryotic means before the nucleus, because they've existed longer than nuclei have existed. And eukaryotic means having a true nucleus. Well, a true nucleus is an example of a membrane-bounded organelle, meaning a subcellular, smaller than cell structure that is enclosed by its own membrane, right? That's the nucleus fits that description. But there are many different kinds of membrane-bounded organelles, and even though eukaryotes are named for just that one membrane-bounded organelle, the nucleus, they also have the others as well. And prokaryotic cells not only don't have a true nucleus, they don't have any other membrane-bounded organelles either. Now, what that means is that prokaryotic cells, or an individual prokaryotic cell, has only one membrane, the same membrane that any cell, by definition, has, right? What really defines the cell itself is its plasma membrane, which is the boundary between that cell and everything else in the universe. That's what makes the cell effectively a tiny test tube in which its particular chemistry, which we call life, happens in isolation from the rest of the universe. So every cell has a plasma membrane, including prokaryotic cells, but that's the only membrane that a prokaryotic cell has. And therefore, it only has one compartment inside it, because it only has that one membrane. And all of that stuff collectively that's inside a prokaryotic cell is called the cytoplasm, which is an apt word, because cyte means cell, plasm means stuff, it just means cell stuff. All right, now the cytoplasm includes, of course, in a prokaryotic cell, the DNA, because a prokaryotic cell needs DNA for the same reason that a eukaryotic cell does. So just because it doesn't have a nucleus doesn't mean it doesn't have DNA. The DNA is just part of the cytoplasm, though, in a prokaryotic cell. It's not, though, spread everywhere in throughout the cytoplasm. It's kind of condensed in one region of the cytoplasm, and we call that region the nucleoid, which, of course, since has the oid ending, means like a nucleus, but it's not a true nucleus because it doesn't have its own membrane. Just be careful with the words nucleus and nucleoid. Ribosomes can be considered organelles as well. Organelle simply means little organ-like thing within a cell. Well, ribosomes are found in both types of cells, prokaryotic and eukaryotic, for the same reason. They do the same job in both cells. What is the job of ribosomes? No. They are involved in information, but not that way. Yeah.
They copy like a inverse of the DNA and then go out of the nucleus. Right?
Well, that's not involving ribosomes. That what you just described is transcription. Yeah, transcription involves the DNA and it uses the information to make an mRNA molecule. That doesn't involve a ribosome. And then after transcription, you have translation, in which the message in the messenger RNA tells the ribosome how to assemble a polypeptide. So translation is the job of ribosomes. Without ribosomes, you don't have the ability to make proteins, and therefore you can't live. So that applies to prokaryotic cells just as much as it does to our own cells. So this doesn't, even though they are organelles, this does not violate anything I've told you about prokaryotic cells not having membrane-bounded organelles, because even though ribosomes are organelles, they are not membrane-bounded organelles. They don't have their own membrane enclosing the ribosome. It's just a molecular machine, basically. Yeah.
And I was also, you said without the proteins, you can't live.
Right.
You said that the protein was one of the most important living pieces because it does most for the body, right?
Well, proteins aren't themselves living. They're just macromolecules.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're you can't really get away without having any of the four major.
Right.
But protein is truly important just because of how many different jobs they do. Each individual protein does one job, but proteins as a group, yeah, do just about everything that's important in the cell. They're either directly do it or they're involved in it. Every cell has a plasma membrane, including prokaryotic cells, but a typical prokaryotic cell will, in addition to that plasma membrane, have a much thicker and tougher cell wall exterior to that, as you see here. The cell wall in prokaryotes is made of different stuff compared to the cell wall in plants, which are, of course, eukaryotic, but it's there for the same purpose, to hold in the pressure, to keep the cell from exploding, which is a particularly big deal for a unicellular organism, right? If you lose a cell, you're not going to notice it. In fact, you lose billions every day and have to make billions of new ones to make up for it. But if you lose the only cell that you are, that means you're dead. So the cell wall is really important for a bacterium or a typical prokaryote. What else do we have besides bacteria that are prokaryotic? Yeah, all the members of archaea, that other domain. So bacteria and archaea collectively make up the prokaryotes. go on to three now. And for the rest of this, we'll be using eukaryotic cells as what we're looking at. But in slide three, we can see a piece of the plasma membrane. And you can see that the main substructure, the main makeup of the plasma membrane is the phospholipid bilayer. Each one of these gray heads and the two tails that are attached to it is one phospholipid molecule. We already talked about the importance of these. And they self-assemble into the bilayer, like I've talked about already. But a plasma membrane, it has to be more than just a phospholipid bilayer. Because even though that will make a boundary between extracellular fluid and intracellular fluid, certain things will be able to get right through that phospholipid bilayer and certain other things won't be able to. And that can't allow for life because there are certain things that a cell, in order to live, needs to get into and out of itself, but that won't get through the actual phospholipid bilayer and therefore needs help to get through. That's why the second main thing that making up a complete plasma membrane after the phospholipids is a set of proteins, which we call membrane-bound proteins. Here, once again, is the difference between the phrases membrane-bounded and membrane-bound. Membrane-bound means part of the membrane, tied to the membrane. These are membrane-bound proteins. Membrane-bounded, like an organelle can be, like the nucleus, means enclosed by its own membrane. So these purple things embedded in the membrane are membrane-bound transport proteins. Well, that's what most of them do. Most of them are transport proteins. They do other jobs as well. But the transport proteins are truly important because they allow for things that are necessary to get either into or out of the cell to do that, since they can't get through the phospholipid bilayer directly. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. Now, slide four. I was talking about the size of cells earlier in the first slide. There's a range of cell sizes, obviously. There are some bigger ones and smaller ones. But there aren't any cells that are extraordinarily large in all three dimensions at the same time, meaning height, width, and length. There can be a long cell, but it's going to have to be a thin cell in the other dimensions. Okay? Most cells are pretty compact, so they're small in all three dimensions. But no cell can be big in all three dimensions. When you started your life officially, even though your life is really just a continuation of billions of years of living cells that have given rise to new cells, your official life started when your zygote was formed, right? Which happened during fertilization. Fertilization produces a zygote when the two gametes fuse. So that's the beginning of you, that one cell, which then split into two cells and more, making the embryo. Eventually you developed into a fetus, and then eventually you were born. You were already very multicellular by the time you were born, but you added a hell of a lot more cells since then. The point is, you grew tremendously from an invisible zygote to now the size of an adult human. You did not, though, just become a human-sized cell. The zygote can't possibly get as big as a human, which is big in all three dimensions. No cell can. That's the point of this slide. And that's because there's a constraint put on the size of cells that we call the surface area to volume ratio. Like any ratio in math, it's one number divided by another number, right? It's a fraction. And so the surface area to volume ratio is the ratio of the surface area, whatever its value is, to the volume of the cell. Well, just to make it mathematically easy to work with, let's consider a perfectly cubical cell. Most cells are not a perfect cube, but you can imagine it as a cube. And it really doesn't matter what the units are here, which is why they're not listed. This is a 1x1x1 cell, though. Okay. Now, how do you calculate the surface area of that cell if it's a cube? What is it? Length times width gives you the area of one face. And there are six identical faces, right? So it's length times width times six, which in this case is one times one times six. That's why the surface area, total surface area, is six square units, whatever the units are. Okay? How do you calculate the volume? Length times width times height. Length times width times height, which in this case is one times one times one. So the surface, the surface area is six square units. The volume is one cubic unit. All right? That means for this cell, the surface area to volume ratio is 6 divided by 1, which is 6. Okay? Now let's imagine this cell, starting out as a 1 by 1 by 1, grows. And let's say, according to the picture, that it gets 5 times bigger in all three dimensions. It gets 5 times taller, 5 times wider, 5 times deeper. So now it's a cube that's 5 by 5 by 5. Each individual face has an area of 5 times 5, right, or 25. But there are 6 of them, so 6 times that is 150. 150 square units of area. The volume is 5 times 5 times 5, which is 125 cubic units, right? But look what's happened to the ratio. The surface area to volume ratio is now 150 divided by 125, which is only 1.2. So by growing, the surface area to volume ratio gets smaller. And that makes sense mathematically, because if you think of the graph of y equals x squared, which represents area, for just the positive part, that looks like this, right? Parabola. For y equals x cubed, which is volume, it's also curves up, but it gets steep faster, right? In other words, volume outgrows area. Volume grows more quickly than area does as you increase the length or the dimension, the characteristic dimension. So that means since the surface area to volume ratio is the area which grows slower divided by the volume which grows quicker, it goes down as the cell grows. And the reason this puts a limit or a constraint on how big cells can get is that in order for cells to remain alive, they have to be able to get the things they need into themselves and the things that their wastes they need to get out of themselves. In other words, they need to exchange things with the outside continuously in order to live. Well, where do you make that exchange if you're a cell? Where are things exchanged with the outside? At the membrane, which is the boundary between you and the outside, right? Or you as the cell. You're imagining that you're a cell. So if you get too big, you no longer have enough area to service that much volume. And you therefore can't make enough exchange to remain alive. So that's why cells can't get indefinitely big. They can get really long, like a neuron, for instance, goes all the way from my spinal cord to the tip of my toe. That's an extraordinarily long single cell, but it's still invisibly thin and tall. So there's still a hell of a lot of area for not much volume. If it were to get that big in all three dimensions, it would be way too big. This is why we don't see enormous cells. Oh, I forgot the rest of this, though. Instead, when organisms get big, they don't do that by growing the one cell that they start out as. Instead, they just add a bunch of smaller cells. So the 100 trillion cells that you're made out of are basically the same size as the zygote you started out as. And each one of them individually still has a high surface area to volume ratio and therefore can stay alive. Just like you see here. This is the same overall volume of organism as the one that is just one huge cell, but it's made of many individual cells, each of which still have a 6 surface area to volume ratio. Yeah.
Do we still contain the cells that we originally had, or do we renew ourselves?
We renew ourselves because when a cell splits, I shouldn't say renew, you don't have the original cells because when a cell reproduces, It's different from, for instance, a human woman reproducing. Usually nowadays things go right and she will survive the birth process, right? So she still exists, now there's a new human. But when a cell reproduces, it splits into two cells and the original cell is no longer there. Instead, you just have two cells that came from it and replace it, though. So no, you don't have any original cells. Not only that, though, you're continuously renewing parts of your body. You know, like if you look at a mole or something that you have, it seems like it's the same mole that you've had for years. It's not made of the same cells. They're being replaced with identical cells that look just like them later. All right, let's go to five. This is a cartoon drawing of a eukaryotic cell, and specifically, more specifically than eukaryotic, it's an animal cell. We'll have a picture that looks very much like it for a plant cell, but this one's an animal cell. And this is not only a cartoon, obviously, but it's also kind of a catch-all picture, because not every animal cell will have all of these features. They're just all lumped together to show you them in one figure. And I want to take a couple minutes more on this slide than I do on the others, to just because I want to go through the major functions of these things as I describe them. The rest of the slideshow will go quicker. But I said it's a eukaryotic cell, as all animals are, and you can tell that because it has membrane-bounded organelles, including the nucleus that eukaryotes are named for. So a true nucleus is a true nucleus if it has its own membrane. It's an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. Not only is it an example of a membrane-bounded organelle, but the nucleus is also an example of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, meaning it's an organelle enclosed by multiple membranes, not just one. There are two membranes that make up what we call the nuclear envelope that surrounds the nucleus. Now, keep in mind that a single membrane, whether it's plasma membrane or membrane of any other organelle, it's really made out of the same stuff. And a single membrane is a bilayer already, right? There are two layers of phospholipids that make up one membrane. Well, the nucleus has two of those, so it's two bilayers. It's like two layers of membrane. And you can see this in better detail in a closer-up slide later, but you can almost see it if you're close enough right here. There's two layers of membrane here. And it's also studded here and there with protein complexes that have a shape that makes them work as tunnels, or little pores, as they're called, nuclear pores. Now, I already mentioned why nuclear pores, I think I mentioned why they're important. Obviously, pores are holes, right? But why is it important for the nucleus to have holes? It is part of selective permeability.
Oh, right.
That is true, but specifically for the nucleus, what are the holes for? What goes on in the nucleus, which is where the DNA is? Not ribosomes. mRNA, right. Transcription, which directly involves DNA, has to occur where the DNA is, right? In a eukaryotic cell, the DNA is in the nucleus. That's what the nucleus is for. So that's where transcription occurs, and therefore that's where messenger RNA is created. Translation, though, which involves that messenger RNA, needs to happen where the ribosomes are. Well, they're out in the cytoplasm, not in the nucleus. So the mRNA needs to exit the nucleus to get to the ribosomes, and it does so through these nuclear pores. By the way, I mentioned when we were talking about prokaryotic cells that single compartment that they have is collectively called the cytoplasm. A eukaryotic cell also has a cytoplasm, but it's not just everything in the cell, because by having membrane-bounded organelles, a eukaryotic cell is compartmentalized. It's not just one compartment. Each membrane-bounded organelle is its own compartment. And so the cytoplasm is everything that is inside the eukaryotic cell but outside all of the membrane-bounded organelles that are inside that cell. Now, the nucleus, as I said, is one example of a membrane-bounded organelle, and the stuff that's inside it is called the nucleoplasm, stuff of the nucleus. All right? Now, if you look closely, you'll see a better view later, you can see that the outer membrane of the two that make up the nuclear envelope, the outer membrane here and there folds outward, and it's changing color from purple to blue, even though it's the same membrane, really. It changes color because each color represents a different organelle. But the point here is that the next organelle I'm going to mention is really continuous with the membrane of the nuclear envelope. And it folds outward and elaborates or folds back and forth quite a few times to make up this blue overall membrane-bonded organelle that we call the endoplasmic reticulum. That's the name of the overall organelle, but there are two major components of the endoplasmic reticulum, as you can see with the brackets here, or the bracket. And those are called the rough endoplasmic reticulum, rough ER, and the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, that not only have different names, even though they're parts of the same organelle, but they have different anatomy, they have different form, shapes, and they also have different functions. The rough ER gets its roughness, it looks rough in appearance under microscopy, because of all these little brown dots on the surface of the membrane of the rough part. Those little brown dots in this cartoon are ribosomes, which I already told you are organelles for translation, right? That's where polypeptides are built. Well, the rough ER is studded with a bunch of ribosomes at any given moment because the job of the rough ER is to take in newly formed polypeptides. As they're being made right off the assembly line, they're strung into the hollow interior, which we use a word lumen to indicate. Lumen just means the interior of something that's hollow. So these polypeptides get strung into the lumen of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and the rough ER then modifies these brand new proteins in some way. Depending on the protein, it'll be a different modification. But they get modified by the rough ER so that they can do whatever their intended function is. All right? Yeah.
And I know you said the ribosomes, if there's not enough to make a bracelet, like how you were describing.
Yeah.
Where would it show it on the extra pieces?
Not anywhere on this picture, but we'll see slides later where you can see the individual amino acids coming off the assembly line going into the rough ER. So that'll be a better picture to look at. This is a too wide an angle. We're zoomed out. Okay, so that's the main job of the rough ER. The smooth ER is still part of the same membrane. It's just folded differently into a different shape for the smooth part. It's more tubular than like flat sacs. But the smooth ER doesn't have those ribosomes associated with it, which is why it looks smooth. Since it makes sense for it not to have the ribosomes, because the smooth ER's job is not to modify proteins, and therefore it doesn't have to be associated with these ribosomes that are making those proteins. Instead, the major job of the smooth ER is to make lipids. That's true for most cells. And they can also be, the smooth ER can also be a storage place for instance, calcium ions get stored in smooth ER, especially in your muscles. Your muscles contract, part of that contraction involves release of calcium ions from the smooth ER into the cytoplasm. Okay, so that's the ER, endoplasmic reticulum. Now, if it weren't for different coloration here in this cartoon, you might mistake this next one for just another part of the rough ER. But this teal-colored one is called the Golgi apparatus. named after a dead Italian. It can also just be called the Golgi, or it can be called the Golgi complex. Those all really mean the same thing when you see them in different books. It's also, it looks very close, I mean, it looks very similar to the rough ER because it's made the same way. It's made out, made up of membranes folded back and forth into sac-like flatness. But it has a totally different job. It is right next door, though, to the rough ER for a good reason. I said that the rough ER modifies newly made proteins. When it does that, or after it does that, it then packages those modified proteins into vesicles. Now, a vesicle is simply a small sac made out of membrane. And the membrane that makes up the vesicles that the rough ER packages these proteins in is part of the membrane of the rough ER. It just takes a little bit of its own membrane, pinches it off, and encloses those newly made proteins. That's a vesicle. Okay, so the rough ER exports via a vesicle these newly modified proteins and sends them to the Golgi complex, sends the vesicles. The Golgi complex functions very much like a receiving and shipping center at a factory, for instance. Right? You have a shipping center, you have a receiving center. The trucks bringing things in go to the receiving center. The trucks picking things up to take out are going to the shipping center. Well, there are two different ends to this Golgi complex. The receiving end is the end that is the side on that's facing the rough ER. Okay, so that surface receives these vesicles. Now, all membrane, whether it's plasma membrane or membrane of an organelle, is made of the same stuff, basically. So it will, if it meets another piece of membrane, it will fuse into it. So the vesicles that pinch off of the rough ER carrying newly modified proteins will then fuse with the membrane of the Golgi and spill their contents into it. Okay? That's the receiving job of the Golgi. The Golgi then, having received the modified proteins, will figure out where these proteins need to go to do their job. They could be sent to another organelle, stay inside the cell, in other words. They could be embedded into the plasma membrane, or they could be fully exported out of the cell. And the Golgi figures that out, packages them in brand new vesicles that it makes out of its own membrane, and sends them to the appropriate place. That's the shipping job of the Golgi. Okay, now do you have a question?
Yeah. Does it ever run out of the rough ER tissue?
No, it's a good question. It would if it weren't for the fact that it's always receiving vesicles from elsewhere in the cell to give membrane back. Okay. And the same is true for the plasma membrane. It's always changing because it's always getting new membrane from vesicles that are fusing with the plasma membrane. But it's also always giving up membrane whenever it undergoes endocytosis, which will pinch off a little piece of itself for a vesicle that is now inside of it. So membrane is continuously being recycled and being parts of different membrane-bounded organelles all the time.
So
it's just reused.
It could be used on any other piece in this image, right?
That's right. Well, almost any of them. Almost anything that's made of membrane, yes, it can be part of. Now, the next one, and there's no particular order to these, but the next one I'll mention is a lysosome, which there isn't necessarily one or any given number of these. Like I said, this is a catch-all picture. But a lysosome is a small membrane-bounded organelle that is really a vesicle itself, but it's a vesicle for a specialized function, therefore it has its own name. The some part means body. Somatic is a word that means of the body, for instance. Lyse means split. Right, like in hydrolysis. So lysosomes are splitting bodies, named that because their job is to contain enzymes that will hydrolyze or break apart bigger molecules into smaller ones. All right? In other words, hydrolysis happens in a lysosome. Now, these enzymes that are responsible, they're catalysts that speed up these hydrolysis reactions and split big things into small. These are dangerous things to have around the rest of the cell because they might start splitting apart the components of the cell itself. They're contained, therefore, in their own little bags, the lysosome, so that if you put the thing you want to split into it, it will be exposed to those enzymes safely away from the rest of the cell. Yeah?
So I get the lysosome probably, well, it's extremely small on the outside of the cell, right?
No, it's not. It looks like it is. This is you're looking through the plasma membrane here.
Oh, okay.
So they're all inside, however many there are.
But it's on the membrane of the cell.
No, not necessarily. It's somewhere in there. This is showing you as a translucent plasma membrane, and this is deeper behind the level of the screen.
Okay.
In the case if it gets damaged, like the outside of it gets damaged, is there a case where stuff will get outside of it and mess up inside?
Yeah, that's a possibility, and that's one way things can go wrong in the cell. But if those dangerous enzymes do get released, they're at least not permanently there. If the cell survives any damage that they can do, the proteins that are the enzymes themselves will eventually be themselves degraded, and they therefore will lose their dangerous function. Okay, above that in the picture is a mitochondrion, the orange one, bean-shaped thing. Mitochondrion is the singular. If you're talking about more than one of them, they are mitochondria. But a mitochondrion is a second example, after the nucleus, of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. Just like the nucleus, the mitochondrion has multiple membranes. It has an outer membrane and an inner membrane, and you see that in this cutaway view. This is not the surface. It's been cut so you can see the inside. There's an outer membrane and an inner membrane. And we will pay much more attention to the mitochondrion in Unit 3, which is the hardest part of the course, so I don't want to say much more about it except its overall function, which is its main overall function, is a complex set, not just a single reaction, but a complex set of biochemical reactions that collectively we call cellular respiration. And we'll study the details of cellular respiration in a different chapter, but that's what mitochondria do. And the purpose of cellular respiration is to drastically increase the efficiency of fuel consumption, meaning that the fuel which comes from the food we eat contains a certain amount of energy. By using cellular respiration, we can maximize the usable amount of that energy. We can burn it much more efficiently and end up making a lot more ATP for useful things in the cell. And that happens in mitochondria. Peroxisome is listed next. I guess we're working clockwise. A peroxisome is shaped just like a lysosome for good reason. They're both vesicles, really. But peroxisomes do a different job. They get their name because they have enzymes in them that deal with what are called reactive oxygen species. Include peroxide is an example of something that the cells naturally make, various kinds of peroxides, which are very highly reactive. Peroxides are reactive substances, which is why hydrogen peroxide, for instance, will bubble on your hand if you put it on a cut. These peroxides can be damaging to the cell itself if they build up, but the cell has to make them as a normal part of living. And so peroxisomes have the specific function of turning those peroxides into things that aren't as reactive. Yeah.
So it looks like that there's a pattern with anything that can be ending.
Soam?
Soam is anything that can harm the cell, right?
Well, not necessarily. It's just called that because it's a small body, and that's all soam means.
Okay.
But it is true that peroxisomes and lysosomes both Yeah, lysosomes, though, it's not necessarily the thing that you're splitting apart is harmful. It's just that the enzymes that will split it apart could also split apart other parts of the cell. Microvilli are, literally, that means small villi, villus, U.S. ending, is a general word that means finger-like projection. And so there are villi in very different parts of the body, including the tongue, for instance. Actually, those are better described as papillae, which is another word that means basically the same thing. But anyway, microvilli are not really organelles, so to speak. They are just finger-like extensions of the plasma membrane. And some cells will have them, some won't, and they might not be, if a cell does have them, it won't necessarily have them everywhere, like you see here. It's just on one end. Why would you have microvilli? Yeah. Not usually, no.
Would they stick to something?
It could help for that, and for the same reason that we have them to begin with. What they do is drastically increase the surface area without actually increasing the volume. Right? Because all of this stuff between them is outside of the cells, right? Now, if you think about it in two dimensions, since this is a cutaway view, this is kind of, this whole cell is like an island. And the smooth part of the plasma membrane is like the beach around the island, right? And so to get from here to here, some distance, it's a pretty straight walk along the beach. To go the same distance, though, here to here, if you stay on the beach, you're going to have to end up walking a hell of a lot farther, right? Because those folds drastically puts drastically more membrane in without actually making it a very much change in volume. So that's what microvilli do. They increase the surface area in the cases where that is necessary for the cell. A good example in your own body is the epithelial cells that line the inner surface of your small intestine. Your small intestine is where most of the absorption takes place. You can't absorb foods the fuels that are in your foods until they're broken into small enough pieces, molecule size, individual molecules, right? So the proteins you take in from whatever organism you eat will be broken down into their amino acids. Those are then small enough to actually enter the body through the epithelium. But they enter through membrane-bound proteins that are part of that membrane. They can't go directly through the phospholipid bilayer, like I was talking about earlier. They need the help of transport proteins. And therefore, the more membrane you have, the more area you have, the more proteins that are doing the job of helping things through the membrane you can put in there. And therefore, in that amount of time, because there's only a certain amount of time, everything's flowing through you, right? For the amount of time that they're in the small intestine, the more area you have in there, the more you can get them into your body before they pass through you. So that's just one example of why you would have microvilli. Next is an overall structure shown in all caps here called the cytoskeleton. And the reason it has a colon here is because the cytoskeleton really is a big collection of proteins, fibrous proteins, all connected together. And those fibrous proteins come in three major categories, which is what comes after the colon. Microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. They all interconnect, and the cytoskeleton is called that, meaning the skeleton of the cell, because just like your overall bony skeleton, it's a major job of that is a supportive framework, right? So the cytoskeleton is a supportive framework for the organelles. It holds things in place, although not... You should not think of the cell's organelles as always being in one place. The cell is highly dynamic, continuously changing. But that's a major job of the cytoskeleton. And also, the microtubules that are part of that cytoskeleton, they form little roadways that things can be moved from one place in the cell to the next by walking them along these microtubules. So we'll look at closer up views of these three kinds of cytoskeletal proteins in a different slide. The centrosome is this yellow region. This is a confusing thing. Another use of the word "some." The centrosome is not this T-shaped thing. The centrosome is just this region that kind of has this yellow halo. And what the centrosome is in a eukaryotic cell is a microtubule organizing center that is important for a part of cell division that we call mitosis, that we'll study a little bit later. So the centrosome will be there whether it's an animal cell or a plant cell. And that's not to say that those are the only two kinds of eukaryotes. It's not, but two big groups of eukaryotes are animals and plants. Plant cells have centrosomes just like animal cells do. But in animal cells, within the centrosome, you have two complexes of proteins making this T-shape, kind of looks like little pieces of licorice, that are called centrioles. So centrioles are found in animal cells within the centrosome. Plant cells, as we'll look at in a minute, have centrosomes, but their centrosomes don't have centrioles. And to make it even more confusing, we haven't really figured out what centrioles do in animal cells, because we can actually even experimentally remove them and they'll still be able to undergo mitosis successfully. So, and plants do it without centrioles. So it's one of the unanswered questions in biology, exactly what they do, but that's the name. A flagellum is shown here. Now, not all animal cells are flagellated, but what's an example of one with a flagellum? Sperm have a flagellum. The plural of flagellum is flagella, but usually if a cell is flagellated, it will only have one flagellum or some small number. And a flagellum is a long structure that, by moving, pushes on the medium, the surrounding fluid, in other words, whether it's water or extracellular fluid, whatever it is, it will propel that cell through that medium. Yeah.
For the microtubules, I see that it's connected to the
centrosome.
Yeah.
That's why I described the centrosome as a microtubule organizing center.
You said that the microtubules is just like a walking path. Is that how other stuff get around, as in directly to what they need to get to?
Yes. Because not every microtubule is connected to the centrosome, but the ones that are going to be involved in mitosis will be. There are other microtubules running out that you don't see here, though, from place to place, and they're just like little roads. I mean, that's not an analogy. They're literally roads, because there are proteins called motor proteins that walk vesicles one step at a time along these microtubules to get them from one place to another. No, you don't see the detail in this one. All right, that makes us through that. Now let's look at the plant version in slide 6. This one doesn't take as long to describe, because a plant cell has nearly all the same things as an animal cell, but it has some things in addition as well. So I'm not going to go through the things that we've already talked about, the nucleus, endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi. Those are all the same in a plant cell. One conspicuous difference between a plant cell and an animal cell, and we've already talked about this in lab, is that an animal cell does not have a cell wall. It has just its plasma membrane that any cell will have. Plant cell has a plasma membrane, and then exterior to that, just like in a prokaryotic cell, or a fungal cell for that matter, there is a much thicker and tougher cell wall. And that's why I said in lab that the plasma membrane is like the paint, whereas the wall itself, that thicker structure, is like the cell wall. The green things we don't find in animal cells, but we do in plant cells, and those are called chloroplasts. So this is the third and last example that I'll give you of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. So we had the nucleus, the mitochondrion. Well, the chloroplast is also made up of multiple membranes. And you can kind of see that in the cartoon version. Just like the mitochondrion, which, by the way, plants also have. Plants have their own mitochondria. But in addition to the mitochondria, they have chloroplast. Just like the mitochondrion has a specific job, which is a complex set of reactions that I told you about. That same is true for chloroplasts. That complex set of reactions is photosynthesis. And photosynthesis we're also going to study in detail in its own chapter, so I don't want to get too deep into that. But photosynthesis allows the plant to make organic molecules out of inorganic sources of carbon, specifically carbon dioxide. So remember when we talked about the word organic in the previous chapter? It means carbon-containing, but it means more than that, right? Because pure carbon is not organic, even though it's nothing but carbon. So organic means carbon-containing compounds, so it's carbon along with other stuff. And even then, there are a few exceptions, right? Carbon dioxide is not considered organic. Well, carbon dioxide contains carbon, but we cannot use carbon dioxide for our carbon needs at all. We absolutely, like any organism, require carbon to make our various organic compounds, but we can't use inorganic sources of carbon that's just inaccessible to us. That's why we rely on organisms that can do that for us. Plants are examples of that. This process is called carbon fixation, and I'll go over this again later, but that is really the most important thing about the chloroplast. It allows for carbon fixation, which is incorporation of inorganic carbon sources, or carbon atoms from inorganic carbon sources into organic compounds. That feeds the plant, which is why it's doing it, of course. It doesn't care about us. But thankfully, since it does that, we're able to exist. We rely on the plants to feed us. They're doing it to feed themselves. Another thing that you see in plant cells that you don't in animal cells are these plasmodesmata. And that is a plural word. If you're talking about just one of them, it's a plasmodesma without the TA. But plasmodesmata are complexes of proteins arranged in such a way that they form little tunnels through the plasma membrane and cell wall. Actually, specifically through the cell wall only. They don't really penetrate the plasma membrane. You can see that in this cutaway view. It's a tunnel through the cell wall, but this lighter yellow, not the brown, which is cell wall material, this yellow, that's the plasma membrane. And so the plasma membrane doesn't have a hole in it. Instead, it wraps through the tunnel as well, like paint on the interior of the cell, which is continuous with paint along the tunnel, which will then be continuous with the plasma membrane in the next cell. So the plasma membrane of a plant cell is continuous with the plasma membrane of the next plant cell. And anything that can get through these plasmodesmata can go from one cell to the next. That's what the purpose of these are. They are intercellular junctions, which means a joining place between two cells, that allow for communication. Communication in the form of transfer of materials from one cell to the next. Yeah.
You know how, animals are about to be a lot bigger, before humans existed and stuff? Mm-hmm. Would that be the same for plants? Do you think there were, flowers that were, super tall and stuff like that?
As far as we know, they didn't undergo this gigantism that because there was a time when there were dragonflies with 2-foot wingspans and things like that. I don't think so for plants, though. Plants started out much smaller. They couldn't get big until they became vascular. There are still plants that are non-vascular, like the mosses. When you look at moss, you usually don't pay attention to it. It looks like velvet on the ground. You don't even bother to look at it. But it's not a huge forest of moss, right? It can't be big because it doesn't have any vessels. And therefore, it can't... If you're a big organism, you have a lot of cells that are far away from the surface, and therefore diffusion isn't capable of getting things that deep into you, unless you have a system of tubes that are circulating fluid, like our blood vessels. That's what allows us to be big. Plants eventually evolved that in the vascular plants, and they are the ones that got big. But that's much more recently. Yeah?
Isn't the purpose of having the dragonfly so big, or any type of insect, was because there was more oxygen in the air compared to now?
Yeah, that is part of it, yes. These plasmodesmata are plant intercellular junctions. A little bit later in the slideshow, we'll see a few examples of animal intercellular junctions, but we don't use plasmodesmata. We do a similar thing, but we call them a different name. Plasmodesmata are for plants. But what that really means is that the cytoplasm in one plant cell is really continuous with the cytoplasm of all the other cells in that whole plant. Even though you still call it individual cells, it's really all one huge cytoplasm in plant.
So plant has multiple?
No, there's one per cell, but what I'm saying, that's not the cytoplasm. Remember, the nucleus is its own compartment. That's the nucleoplasm. And the stuff that's inside the chloroplast is its own compartment. The stuff inside the mitochondrion is still another compartment. The cytoplasm is all the stuff that's outside of all the membrane-bounded organelles, but still inside the cell. And that's the stuff that is continuous with the next cell because of the plasmodesmata. So, is there anything that I haven't mentioned on this? I don't think so. Oh, yeah, the biggest thing in the picture in the middle, the central vacuole. Now, that word vacuole, same as in the word vacuous or vacuum, means empty. Vacuous means empty. A vacuum is empty, like the vacuum of space, or to evacuate. In any case, it means empty, which is kind of a misnomer. It's drawn here as though there's nothing in it. Of course, there's something in it. It's mostly water, which is why it doesn't look like anything. It's clear, but it's mostly water. And the central vacuole can also contain just about anything else that the plant wants to dump into it. So it's kind of used as a dump to keep whatever it puts in there away from the rest of the cytoplasm. That's one use. But it also, since it is mostly water, and you can see from this picture how much of the overall volume of the cell it actually occupies. This is why certain plants can grow so much more quickly than animals. They both, being multicellular organisms, grow by adding additional cells, right? That's the way you get big, because the constraint put on cell size by surface area to volume ratio that we talked about earlier. But, you know, there's some plant species that overnight they will get much longer. And the reason for that is compared to animal cells, which you would have to add for the animal to get bigger, new plant cells are cheaper to make and quicker to make. And that's because a big fraction of the volume is simply water that doesn't have to be manufactured by the cell. It simply needs to be osmosed into it from the soil. So you'd have this big bag of water that accounts for a big fraction of the volume, and therefore the other stuff that you have to make, you'd have to make all of the animal cell stuff. You wouldn't have to make all of the plant cell stuff. You see what I'm saying? And so they grow a lot quicker. Yeah.
It's kind of a stupid question, but do plants go through like natural selection the way that like animals do?
All organisms do. In fact, even non-organisms, viri, undergo natural selection. Or natural selection changes them, is what I should say. Yes, natural selection operates on anything that is genetic-based. Because anything that can be passed on by passing on genes, natural selection is going to select for the things that happen to work.
How come, since it goes through natural selection, you know, like fruits and stuff that taste really good that like animals eat. How come those plants haven't adapted to taste bad so animals won't eat them?
Well, there are a lot of plants that produce bad-tasting things to keep from being eaten. But in the case of the good-tasting ones, it was actually selected for them being good because the plant uses that as a reward, wanting animals to come along and eat the fruit so that the seeds that are contained in the fruit can be taken away from the plant since the plant's stuck in place so they can grow and spread the population. So it's advantageous to the plant. Yeah.
There's like another reason it has that central vacuole is because like in the cell walls, it can't expand as much.
The cell wall is staying put, and when you in the lab, I don't think today. Then the next lab, you'll play around with plant cells by giving them salt water or pure water, and because of what you've already learned about tonicity, hypotonicity, hypertonicity, and isotonicity. Depending on what kind of solution you give the surroundings of the cell, this central vacuole will get either huge or shrink, whereas the overall cell will stay the same size. And if you do this with a cell that has a dye or a pigment, I mean, inside the central vacuole, like an onion cell, a red onion cell, that pinkness is actually inside here. If this shrinks, it will look like you have a very dark pink circle. If it gets really big, it'll look like the whole cell is a washed out pink. It's not because it's exploded, it's just gotten huge. It's gotten as big as the cell almost. Yeah.
So you just said it doesn't explode, so it can get as big as it wants. And it won't.
I'm not saying that it's impossible for it to explode.
Like a throwaway place, so what if they get...
Anything in there can be damaged, of course. You know, when you chop that carrot, that knife is going to go through cells and damage them. So things can happen, certainly. But they are definitely very stretchy, especially because if it needs more, it can actually simply add more cells. I mean, not cells. Simply add more phospholipids to the membrane, making it even bigger. Yeah, the rest of it I have mentioned. Now we can go to the part where we can speed up a little bit, because these are just really close-ups of all the things we've already gone through. Slide 7 is a closer view of both the nucleus and the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which are shown together because of what I already told you. One becomes the next. They're considered two organelles, but it's really just the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope folding out here and there into the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And this also gives you a much better view of the protein complexes that form the little nuclear pores. Oh, I didn't mention before, because it wasn't on that slide, that within the nucleus, of course, there's DNA, right? But there's a region within the nucleoplasm, the stuff inside the nucleus, that is it's called the nucleolus. Be careful with that word, too. Nucleolus and nucleus are not the same thing, but you can easily mispronounce that word when you're reading it to yourself as nucleus. The nucleolus is part of the nucleus, and it is specifically the region in the nucleus where there are genes, which are DNA, responsible for coding for kinds of RNA other than messenger RNA. Messenger RNA is just one type of RNA. There are many types. Well, the cell doesn't know how to make any type of RNA. It needs instructions from DNA. So some of your genes, a minority of them, the vast majority of your genes code for messenger RNA for the purpose of eventually making proteins. But the other kinds of RNA that your cell needs require genes as instructions as well, and those kinds of RNA are made in the nucleolus. Slide 8 is not a membrane-bounded organelle. It's a ribosome. But really, like I said before, a ribosome is just a molecular machine, really. It's not enclosed by its own membrane. It's tiny compared to other organelles. And what you see here in cartoon form is a lie, really. It is true that a ribosome consists of two subunits, one bigger than the other, so a large and a small subunit. But the part that's a lie here is that the two subunits don't actually get together until translation has already started. So you wouldn't see them together with no mRNA between them. We'll look at the details of that later, but they just showed you them together to show you that they, an overall ribosome consists of a large and small subunit. And so there are millions of these things, millions of small subunits, millions of large subunits. All the smalls are identical, all the large are identical, and they're modular. So these two might be together only one time ever, and the next time, once they separate again, this small subunit will get together with some other large subunit. Doesn't matter. They're interchangeable. I mentioned that they are responsible for the rough appearance and therefore the name of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, but those are not the only ribosomes. There are a lot of ribosomes that are just on their own out in the cytoplasm. And those are called free ribosomes because they're not attached to anything. They're not attached to a membrane, I should say. When they do become attached, if they do become attached to a membrane, then they are called bound ribosomes. So the ribosomes that are on a rough ER are bound ribosomes. But they started out as free ribosomes, actually, and then became bound. So part of the dynamic nature, ever-changing nature of the cell is that the roughness of the ER is made up of by a totally changing population of ribosomes. They stay on only so long until they're done with that protein, then they separate and come off, and new ones will replace it from the cytoplasm. Slide 9. A better view of the packaging of modified proteins occurring at the rough ER. I said it in words, but you have it in cartoon form here. Remember I said that once it modifies the proteins, it packages them in little vesicles that it pinches off of its own membrane. So this is a vesicle that is going to be sent to the very next thing in line, right, which is the Golgi complex. And specifically the receiving end of the Golgi complex. In slide 10, we see the Golgi. Well, since it has two different ends that do different things, shipping and receiving, we say that this organelle is polarized, which has nothing to do with charge, right? Polarized just means that there are two different ends. And so we call these the cis face and the trans face. Same words that we used for geometric isomers, right? The cis isomer and the trans isomer. Cis means same side, trans means across. So the cis face is the receiving end. That is the part that's right up against the rough ER. So this vesicle that budded off of the rough ER doesn't have to travel very far before it reaches the cis face or the receiving end of the Golgi, where it, since it's made out of membrane, just fuses into the membrane of the Golgi and spills its contents of modified proteins into it. Yeah?
Is that why it's a circle, so that way it goes directly to...
It's a circle simply because that's the least energetic shape to have. If you wanted it to have any other form, it would require energy to keep it in that shape. Same reason raindrops are spherical, other than the fact that they're distorted by falling. If they were in space, they would be perfect spheres. Now, once the contents of the vesicles is spilled into the lumen of the Golgi figures out where they need to go, and then it packages it into a new vesicle, budding off of itself on the trans face, and that vesicle will either go to another organelle, depending on what it figured out as the destination, or it will go to the plasma membrane and fuse into the plasma membrane. And if it does that, if the proteins were inside the vesicle, then they will be spilled out of the cell. That's exocytosis. If the proteins were actually in the wall of the vesicle, then when that vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, they will now be part of the plasma membrane. They'll be membrane-bound proteins within the plasma membrane. So the plasma membrane is continuously adjusting which particular proteins are part of it by receiving new ones and taking up old ones by the reverse process, which is endocytosis. Speaking of endocytosis and exocytosis, slide 11 gives you cartoon pictures of these. The overall process of moving something into a cell or out of a cell via a vesicle, which is something we talked about in the last lab, is vesicular transport. Right, remember you have active transport, passive transport, and vesicular transport. Vesicular transport involves a vesicle. Well, there's two ways that that can happen based only on the direction, either into the cell or out of the cell. Inward movement of things via a vesicle is called endocytosis. Endo meaning inside, cyte meaning cell, and osis meaning condition. The reverse of that, using a vesicle that starts out inside the cell and then spilling the contents out of the cell, is exocytosis. Okay, exo meaning outside. Well, endocytosis, which is inward vesicular transport, can be subdivided into two categories, which we see one of here. Phagocytosis is a specific kind of endocytosis. So you're bringing something in via a vesicle, but what does the phago part of that word mean? It means eat. So this really means cell eating, literally. And that's because the pack, the cargo that is taken in via a vesicle in phagocytosis is solid chunks, not liquid, like this brown thing. Okay? And so we eat solid things, we drink liquid things, right? That's why it's called cell eating or phagocytosis. The same exact thing can happen, though, but instead of bringing in solid chunks, it's really just taking a sip of the liquid outside and bringing it in, in which case that would be cell drinking, which is called pinocytosis. So those are the two types of endocytosis, phagocytosis and pinocytosis. On the right side, we have something that's related called autophagy. Same phage part, right, which means eat. And auto means what? Auto means self. So this means self-eating. What's happening here is that this, just using it for an example, a mitochondrion has seen better days. It's no longer functioning properly, but it's made of very valuable molecules, right? They just don't work as a mitochondrion anymore. So the cell is going to autophagize it, or break it down for its raw materials, using these dangerous enzymes I was talking about that would be dangerous to have around the rest of the cell. So it packages it into a vesicle by surrounding the mitochondrion with membrane, and then that membrane can fuse with a lysosome that already has the enzymes in it, and now the two are in contact with each other, and the mitochondrion will be broken down for raw materials and released to the cell and made into brand new stuff that might be a totally different organelle. The central vacuole slide in slide 12 doesn't really give you any new information beyond what I've told you. It just gives you a better view of it. And you can see in the real example, this is a cartoon obviously, but this is a real photomicrograph. You can see just how much of the interior is really just water, which is why I was saying plants can add cells so quickly. They're cheap to make compared to something that you'd have to make all this whole interior out of raw materials. You don't have to make water. So I better stop there. Remind me I'm on 13.